Good evening, everyone. This is Shai Danon from Raising the Frequency, straight from Israel. And today I'm with a special guest, Alex Thompson. And we will speak about very, very interesting things. Now, I will obviously wait until some of you will join this talk, and then we can bring Alex in. And meanwhile, let me play something and share this video. Stay with us. Yes. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for being with us. I will send you, while I'm sharing on Telegram, I will share you the link here to share it wherever you want to your friends and family. And I'm going to bring in Alex Thompson right now. Hi, Alex. How are you doing? Good evening.
Good evening. Doing very well indeed, Shai. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Whereabout are you at the moment?
I'm near Rotterdam. I'm British, and I moved to the Netherlands in 2009 to marry a Dutch girl.
Nice. I think we're going to have a very interesting discussion this evening. It may be even morning at some places around the world, but we are more or less on the same time and hopefully on the same page. while you introduce yourself to the audience, because most of them do not know you, while you introduce yourself, I will share this broadcast in some groups on Telegram in English and Hebrew groups. Is that all right?
That's absolutely fine. Excellent. And I'll start with the present day. Through all the twists and turns of my life, I have now become, among other things, a teacher of biblical Hebrew in the seminary of a very conservative Dutch Reformed church, which I married into. I also teach biblical Hebrew to Ukrainian students who are translating the Bible. So that is most directly of interest to an Israeli and Jewish audience, I think. I'm not a Jew. I'm a Christian. And unlike some people in the free media or the new media, I don't shy away from saying what I am, because I think that Jews will agree. Everyone has a particular philosophy or worldview, and it will come into the open anyway. It will become evident what you believe through what you say, what you don't say, the way you say it. The selection and presentation of facts, as they used to say, that's the inevitable bias or worldview that there is. And so I was very delighted and honored and surprised to be asked to talk to Israelis and Jews about Zionism and Judaism. But it's not an invitation that I would refuse. And they do have a saying, a lot of people think it's biblical, but it isn't. It's just a folk proverb, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. There's something of truth about that whenever we talk about Judaism and Zionism. In fact, people should see this as the first in a trio of interviews, because I have recommended to you my very dear friends, Georg Viratz, an Armenian, and David Scott in Scotland, to complement what I have to say when you kindly invited me, because those two men I regard as my personal experts on Judaism and Israel. These are men who have regularly visited Israel and stayed with all kinds of different Jews, from entirely secular to deeply Orthodox, and some who reject the legitimacy of the State of Israel. And these are guys who are very well versed in the history. But yes, to give a bit of background on who I am, well, I now work with the, I think we dare to say, the leading British free media platform, UK Column, which is ukcolumn.org. And I've been with them for nearly a decade, almost as long as I've been in the Netherlands. Before that, I was with British Intelligence, where I didn't get to have a jaunt to Israel to visit Unit 8200, but the guys who sat 3 feet away from me did, and were raving about it when they came back. This was something which, when I was in GCHQ, Britain's Signals Intelligence Agency, so the British sister agency to NSA in the States and 8200 in Israel, that relationship was so super secret I couldn't even talk to other cleared people. It was above top secret. No sooner had I left than the number two of the British government at the time, Francis Maude, proudly boasted that Britain's GCHQ, which I had recently left, had an extremely intimate cybersecurity and intelligence relationship with Unit 8200. That was one of the moments at which I realized I'd made the right decision to step away, because it indicated to me that something other than the national interest of either Britain or Israel was at play in this relationship. The world had gone topsy-turvy. So, well, I could talk more about my details of life, but those are the main things that are relevant to your viewers, I think, that I am no stranger and no beginner to Judaism, Tanakh, Jewish philosophy. I've always been friendly and interested in talking to the Jews around me since elementary school, where there was one Jewish boy in my class. He was at pains to stress that Judaism and Christianity were the same religion. He was keener on it than I was, which I think says a thing or two. Right the way through to the present day, where the church I'm in, most of its members are not just pro-Jewish, but pro-State of Israel. And they have a national newspaper, Reformatoris Dagblad, which often reports on events in Israel as though any attack on the State of Israel is an attack on the people of God. That's some of those in my church seem believe that. So there we are. I'm not afraid to tackle the issues, but I confess and acknowledge that I've never been a particular student of rabbinical views, much that they differ between themselves. And I've never been a deep specialist in Israeli geopolitics. My specialism was the former Soviet Union. But through that link, I know a fair bit, as any educated observer would do who's in media, about the diversity of opinion in Israel itself today.
All right. Thank you for that introduction. A quick question before the question to come. Given your experience with the British intelligence, why should we trust you?
This is often asked, and half of my audience might lose me at this point, and the other half will lose me because I'm talking to an Israeli at all. So you know, there's a very narrow overlap of people in the middle who will trust my intentions. Well, I am honest about my background. I don't hide it. I went into British intelligence for the motives of looking after the country. And I know that, of course, you have your national service in Israel, and the best and brightest get recruited via Talpiot into 8200. So if I had been born in Israel, the equivalent of me wouldn't have had a choice. He would have been allocated. So with me, it was a question of the paradigm I had in life then was, like my parents before me, I was public service rather than a commercially oriented family. So it was an obvious choice to look for the most prestigious and useful work that I could do within that paradigm of being in the civil service. And that turned out to be GCHQ because they were looking for people with rare languages of the former Soviet Union in my case. Disillusioned is the word. I have never considered myself a whistleblower, unlike another girl who actually sat directly opposite me for part of my time at GCHQ, Catherine Gunn, who became quite a well-known whistleblower on preparations for the Iraq war, which many people in my circles in the free media like to blame wholeheartedly on Israel. But that's one of the complications. There was actually far more to it than that. So that from that time onwards, I've never considered myself a whistleblower. I haven't come out running out with secrets. I've simply got slowly and increasingly disillusioned about whether the intelligence agencies in the Five Eyes countries and Israel, because they are a unit with each other now. Sure. That's been, well, you know, Netanyahu acknowledged in 2019 at the Tel Aviv Tech Conference mm-hmm. that Israel isn't the sixth eye, it's the second mm-hmm. eye. And yes. He meant that in terms of manpower, that they're ahead of GCHQ and behind only NSA. But he meant perhaps more than that. And I've laid all my cards out on the table. If people go to ukcolumn.org and go to the search function, the magnifying glass, and type in the word emergency, they will find a briefing I gave in 2018, with the second half of which is very largely about how political Zionism took over the Five Eyes intelligence services and made them serve not even Israel as a state, but some other kind of commercial interest. And that is what Bibi is boasting about. We're the spider at the heart of that web. When he says we, this is the key point, I think, he doesn't mean Amir Israel, and he doesn't mean the Jews, and he doesn't mean the citizens of modern Israel. He means his cabal.
Question. Thank you for that, by the way. Question. obviously, we all know about anti-Semitism, and many people around the world, they are blaming the Jews with the state of the world. I mean, with the so-called corona crisis or the crisis to follow, but obviously they've been doing it even before, blaming the Jews. So my first question is, are the Jews to blame? And if not, who then?
First of all, how do we define the Jews? Now that UK Column has been booted off YouTube, which has filtered comments, every video platform where our episodes and guest appearances appear are smaller video platforms that don't filter the comments. And the comments are dominated by people saying, blame the Jews, name the Jews. Mm-hmm. I have been called a disgusting traitor, a scumbag, and the like by regular viewers, because I will not blame the Jews as the Jews. Having said that, UK Column led, I think, in this effort, well, actually all four of the main contributors, but particularly perhaps Brian Gerrish and David Scott, have a very long and deep interest in the Bible and Jewish history. We don't shy away from talking about problems that center in Israel or that seem to originate territorially from Israel. So we will talk about that, but that isn't enough for some of the audience. And I understand the frustration of some of the people who say that, because many of the memes or textual snippets which have been popularized in the last decade or more, which have done the rounds in the ethno-nationalist scene, talk about this. Much of that material is taken from 100 years ago or more. It's taken from the interwar period, when a large number of largely military writers in the English-speaking world and, of course, in Central Europe started talking about plans for something called world Jewry to become top dog in the geopolitical race. And basically, the rest of the century is a sort of a three-cornered race between the Russians, the Germans, and the Anglos. For domination. And in that scenario, 100 years ago, the proto-Zionists of that time were perfectly open about it, that they wanted to expend one of these guys, first expend Germany and then expend communism and then hop across to Anglo-American supremacy. There were writers at the time, well, it starts with Osman Bey in the late 19th century, and then Louis Marshalko, the Hungarian, writing between the wars, a lot of people of these types. Talk about a plan of world Jewry, but the long and the short of it is there is no the Jews politically united or economically united to talk about. You know, that the question at the heart of this, and it's a question that's asked as early as Paul's writings, the heart of what becomes the New Testament, what is a Jew and who is a Jew? And since people will see that I'm historical in my approach to all these things, because that's where you have to start. Otherwise, nothing makes sense. You don't start with philosophy. You start with historical development, right, when you're examining religion or any other subject in human life. Since the fall of the temple in AD 70, and particularly since the Bar Kokhba revolt, 60 years after that, the Jews were not in the land of Israel for an extremely long time, right? And since that time, every sect in Judaism has had diametrically opposite views to the others about what constitutes a Jew, what constitutes the Torah, what's the purpose of Torah, what's the purpose of life. There's been no unity between them. And this is another key point that I think we'll keep returning to. You Jews and Israelis have a particularly grave problem, I think, compared with other nations in the world, with sellout leadership, a leadership that wishes you ill. We're becoming painfully aware in the West, particularly, I think, in the Anglo countries, that our government hates us and wants us dead, wants us replaced with something. Mm-hmm. This goes back to, well, one theme of this, again, ethno-nationalist, goes back to the 1970s. The French writers of the New Right talking about le grand remplacement, the great replacement, and blaming largely the Jews for that, or Jewish politicians in France. But no, there were papers written at technical level by entirely goy forums of people in the Club of Rome that were saying the same thing. Mankind is the problem, you know? So there's been no unity. And you have, I mean, no Israeli needs to hear this from someone like me, but you have a particularly sharp problem. I think you're beginning to see it in real life in Israel now, with a leadership which is the intellectual heirs, sometimes the literal descendants, the third generation descendants of the original political Zionists of the 1940s. And one section of them, the, you could call them the Ashkenazi chauvinist section, largely Yiddish, largely from Poland and surrounding countries, Galician, has openly said for decades that to have a cow in Palestine is better than all the Jews left in Europe, right? And that is the attitude they have continued from generation to generation. Rothschild said it personally, you know, I think it was on the occasion of one of the worst sinkings of the ships just off the coast of Haifa in the 1940s, when, of course, Jews were desperately trying to get away from the Holocaust. Rothschild, it's attributed to him on that occasion that there will be no room for poor schnorrers in the new land. He was making it perfectly clear that observant Orthodox Jews, whose main goal in life was living faithfully to God and not economic production, that was not what the land of Israel was for. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's the basis of the issue here. So given these issues, which many ethno-nationalists and viewers of the free media are painfully unaware of, they pride themselves on their independence of thought and a broad reading, but they don't know these things, we cannot really posit that there is such a thing as the Jews out to get us, can we?
So who is it then? Who is out there even putting the information about the Jews? I mean, this sidetrack to take the rest of humanity on this sidetrack, and why? I mean, who is it or who are they?
Identify the enemy very hard. I think ultimately we need the theological categories to explain what's happening. And we would not be wrong to say that our enemies, the enemies of humanity, are Satanists. They are actually worshippers of evil. They enjoy wickedness for its own sake. A small but significant proportion of the leadership of every Western country, and Israel is certainly a Western country in these terms, is actively committed to the worship of the devil and is involved in every horror you can imagine, up to the ritual abuse of children and the murder of children. And that is the dominant cabal in the world, not because, you know, everyone above a certain rank is involved, but because they are the most networked, the most determined, the most ruthless, and the least conscientious.
How long do you reckon they've been going on?
As long as mankind, and particularly since the fall of man, described so well in Bereshit. Man opened himself up to these evil influences, and the observant Jews have a lesson to teach the secular Jews in Israel in this regard. The secular Jews, of course, they have received as their founding mythology something which is not particularly Jewish, whether you mean Torah Jewish or ethnically Jewish, but simply the spirit of the age of the 1940s or the 1880s or whenever Zionism was in the ascendancy. And that is the spirit that man can be perfected. If you read Herzl and the others, they're perfectly open about this. They say that the Jew is backward. His problem is he doesn't know who he is. He's more of a leech, an economic slacker than other nations. They're this, you know, again, this Ashkenazi chauvinism, particularly in Western Europe, looking down on the Jews in the Pale in the East. And Herzl's view is, well, give the Jew some real work to do, give him a land of his own, and he'll be, here it comes, just like any other nation, right? Not a light to the nations, not a blessing on mankind. No traditional Jewish definition of Judaism is in there. Herzl and the proto-political Zionists have a totally different definition of a Jew. The Jew's job is, according to them, to strive to be just like anyone else. Yeah, I know that there are those, you know, very, very thoughtful critics of the whole of Judaism and Israel who would disagree, like Gilad Atzmon, whom we've had on before, who in his philosophical way says the whole project of being Jewish is irredeemably associated with difference and superiority. Let him say that. You know, he makes his point strongly. But let's just point out the contradictions here. Is the basis of Judaism and being a Jew to be different in a positive sense, to be a blessing to others, or is it to fade into the background? If that's not resolved, then we don't know what's what, do we?
Why then these groups or families or these Satanists, why they try so hard to convince the rest of us that the Jews are to blame? I mean, why is it? What's there that they need to pick and to show that the Jews are to blame? Are they jealous? Do they envy? Are they angry? I mean, what's there? Not that I really want to understand them. I don't care about them. But
okay,
the audience that I care about. And just to add something, Alex, I mean, you know, I in the same time, I could bring an Israeli guy to speak about these things. But I think it's important, A, to do these conversations in English now.
Yes, so yes.
And allow the rest
the majority of the world's Jews don't speak Hebrew, of course, to this day.
Exactly.
You know, that's one of the failures of Zionism. I mean, they're still outside the land.
Exactly. And not just Jews. I mean, everyone should hear what you have to say, I think. Another thing is you know, it's easy if I bring someone from my people, but if I bring someone from outside who, like yourself, and I tend to bring even more, like you suggested, then I think it gives it even a bit more credibility, given who you are, stuff you've done, and the conclusions you reached to.
Yeah, yeah.
So going back to my question,
yes,
why they want the rest of us to think the Jews are to blame?
The most overused word in this question is scapegoating.
Yes, yeah? Of course.
I think that's the basis of a sound answer. I think it is good disguise. When you are a Satanist, of course, you like to make black appear white and good appear bad and up to appear down. And when you're in that frame of mind, the best thing to do in order to attack the useful Jews in the world, the majority of Jews who are simply getting on with their lives and trying to do their best by their neighbors, whether they're religious or not, the best cover is to, or if you really hate those guys, let's put it that way, then the best thing to do is to pose as them, to replace them. I mean, this is well known in any kind of public relations campaign, isn't it? That it is more effective to masquerade as the product that you want to beat rather than attacking it directly, to be an ersatz, right? And many of you viewers will know this, but for those who don't, that there is a large theory which has been swallowed whole, I think, by a lot of people who have grown disillusioned by the mainstream narrative in the West. There is a theory that the Ashkenazi Jews of the world are not historical genetic Jews at all, but are Khazarians from the North Caucasus, from the southern fringe of the old Tsarist Empire. Mm-hmm. Now, this, Arthur Koestler and others have expounded this theory. And according to the complete version of this theory, everyone up to the Rothschilds of the current day are these crypto-Jews, or the opposite of crypto-Jews. They claim to be Jews, but are not, according to this theory. And what they really want to do, says the theory, is to attack and massacre and genocide the real Jews. Now, this seems a tempting theory until you look at, and I'll make no apologies as a Christian for going back to the Apostle Paul here. He's only one of many Jewish thinkers of different sects who said this in the first century, that he is not a Jew who is one outwardly. In other words, Paul doesn't use the argument of genetics being a first century man, but Judaism, I know it has a very strong component of genetic and an essential component of genetic heritage for halachic purposes today. But in every age, from the pre-biblical right through the biblical period, this is one of the few things that I think, you know, any sensible group of Jews has been agreed on, that there are ways of proselytism and there are also ways to leave Am Yisrael through treason. Right, so it's not a genetic inheritance only. Therefore, the Khazarian hypothesis, which may have a lot of grounding in what happened in the 8th century in the Russian steppe, and there were other mass conversions to Judaism in the same centuries, of course, in Arabia, for example, the King Dhunuwas, a famous example, whole kingdoms became Jewish by religion, though they weren't by ethnicity. That has never been, certainly reading Tanakh, that's never been the heart of what a Jew is about. Okay, you don't just invent overnight that you're a Jew, obviously not. What good does that do anyone? But there are many people from southern Africa to the far eastern end of India who say that they are a lost tribe of Israel. Mm-hmm. You know, bless them. Let them get on with it. They might not be observing kashrut exactly as the rabbis would say, but if their heart's in the right place, let them get on with it. If they think they're Jews, they're not being anti-Semites. They're just, they have a compass that they live by thinking that. And why I say this is to make the obvious point from first principles, that there's got to be some kind of element of choice. You know, that as with any religion or ethnicity you inherit, do you embrace those values or not as you grow up? If we accept that, then the painful recognition, I think, particularly for Jews and their friends, is that it's also possible to grow up in that environment, think, this is a rotten load of old nonsense, and then do your best to undermine it. You know, Karl Marx would be one such figure. There was a particular age, the 19th century, when a lot of guys who were disillusioned former Jews went into this mold, you know, and Herzl himself is one such figure who say, well, no, I've had it with Judaism. If Judaism is to survive, it must be radically reinvented. That gives the devil an opportunity to step in.
So, right, because I know, I mean, most people here maybe don't know, but you've done an extensive research and lecture about the evildoers of the world, the way they see reality, the way they see us, the way they treat us, whether it's like property or cattle or what have you. But I would like to, and maybe we'll go to it in a minute, but I would like to maybe try to and make it more accurate. Do you think that these Satanists, they would like to, I mean, given the whole corona, given it's going on in many places around the world, not everywhere, by the way, but in many countries, do you think still they aim in a specific way towards the Jewish people, the people of Israel who live in Israel? Do they have like special plans for them, maybe like they had 80 years ago?
I think, again, from first principles and logic, that has to be the case. If you are a Satanist, then you are by definition religious, right? Sometimes you will want to deny that. You will want to work undercover as some kind of secular globalist or communist. But if your dedication is to evil and to Satan, then you have a religion. Satan is your God, mm-hmm. right? So one of the corollaries of that is that, okay, LGBT culture is promoted. The sexualization of children is promoted as part of this. Mm-hmm. But in the end state, a bit like when communism is firmly entrenched in a country, those who don't conform, including asexual minorities, are ruthlessly dealt with because they're not productive and they have too much internal drama to be good little working slaves. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So that's, and you can see this written large in the history of 20th century Israel. Certain groups were lured to Israel, being told that they could live their dream on a kibbutz or whatever it may be. As time went on, there was less socialism and more of other dreams. Look at how the refuseniks, the Otkazniki, came to Israel in the 90s, and they discovered it was rather different, and there was a lot of prejudice against them.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's one part of the answer. Another part is, if you are, as I say, again, a Satanist and religious, you're going to particularly hate the Tselem of God, aren't you? You're going to particularly hate any group of people who preserve any idea of what it is that makes man special, what man's mission is, that there is, that the idea that God has a Torah. You're going to attack these people vigorously and preferably get rid of them. So absolutely, I think the aim is that. And yet another part of the answer, I think, is that the real estate, as David Scott likes to say, you'll hear him when you get him to interview, that he has particular thoughts about the city of Jerusalem in this regard. And this is the great prize within the glittering prize, isn't it? To be the owner of Jerusalem, or to be the boss there, is of worldwide significance. Even trumps being the boss in Rome, right? Because even if you get to control the papacy and the Vatican, at the most you will only get to control world Christendom. Okay, so you might get to steer a fifth or a quarter of mankind and their fellow travelers that way. If you get to set up your world bank, world court, and above all, world temple in Jerusalem, if you get to be the pulling the strings of the puppets who are the priests and whatnot there, then you've got a real chance, the best chance in the world, of being boss of the world religion. You know, the majority of mankind will go with it. Much of Islam, much of Christendom, much of Jewry will go along with it. Many of the Eastern religions and the irreligious will also think, well, Jerusalem, that's where it's at. That's the religious center. So there's a very strong push, I think, to get rid, even, you know, specifically within Israel, get the observant Jews out of Jerusalem, or to get them minimized there. But more generally, you know, to make sure that Jerusalem as a center has no other rival religious scheme in it other than globalism.
And we do know that they have such a plan. I mean, to take over Jerusalem with their fake God and fake belief system, and to establish a Satan temple in Jerusalem. Obviously, I know that they will not succeed. I mean, even if four times it may seem they do, like now, for example, we need to be strong. We need to stay strong in our belief and know that we will overcome it with the God, with Big G. And, you know, there's a reason why I ask you to come tonight to this talk, and I divide it into two. One, we started to touch upon, and this is to tell others around the world that there is a difference between Judaism and Zionism. And we touched upon it. Obviously, it's not like going really deeply into it, but still, I would like to hear from you maybe a short message for the Israelis or for the people of Israel, all right? And specifically, maybe those who live in Israel at the moment, but not only, about, I mean, for them to know and to learn about their origin in in comparison with the Zionist story. Because, and the reason why I'm asking you this, because we grew up here in Israel thinking Judaism and Zionism is one thing. Thinking to be a Zionist is to be a good Jew. Thinking that's what we need to do because we have a state now after so many years we didn't have. And we were led into this lie that maybe now many people are starting to wake up from this, you know, nightmare or little sweet dream we were on. And I would like if you can enlighten those who are not fully there or fully understand it, enlighten us. What's the difference there between Judaism and Zionism, and what we need to do maybe in order to strengthen our Israelity or Jewish side and not the Zionist side. And I'm talking obviously mostly about the secular Jews, but not only.
All right. Okay, well, this is a question we have to approach from several angles. Let's try to make it as clear and principled as we can. Let's start with the geopolitical reality. An Israeli today, whether religious or not, who joins the worldwide trend of watching the free media or the new media, who works out that there are globalists, many of whom are Satanists, who wish to reduce the world population and who have a special hatred for positive-minded Jews, shall we say, has got it's an inescapable heritage of being born Jewish. He's got a great privilege and a great weight upon his shoulders. He has to be a philosopher. He has to see things clearly. Now, one of the things he realizes, and you'll know this if you watch UK Column or watch the contributions of the likes of Vanessa Beely and Eva Bartlett, who have been based, Vanessa still is in Syria, is this reality that the nation which drafts your sons and daughters, this is pretty unique in the world, although America, Norway, the Netherlands are now in the same camp as you, they send their daughters to war as well, by force, or at least claim the rights to. This nation that's yours, Israel, you have no other, whether you're a Sabra or among the Olim, you are there. You've got to realize that your policy decision, which tends to be not said so much in Israel, but at foreign minister level abroad, is you have decided not to let any of your neighbors live in peace. Now, that's the first crisis that you have to face, right? There's been a decision which it is fairly obvious. The most obvious expression was the Oded Yinon plan in 1980, but it continues to be something discussed, as I say, between Israeli policymakers and their allies in the West, is that any state which has the potential, not the intention, the potential to cause you casualties on the battlefield is going to be attacked. If it doesn't come to positive or pro-Israeli terms, if it decides to continue in its old attitude towards the geopolitics of the region, then your country is going to attack it. This cannot, on first principles, just logic and morality will tell you that this cannot be a positive way of life for your state. Right. This is particularly poignant, I think, for the large number of evangelical Christians around the world that think that they are doing God's will by supporting the state of Israel through thick and thin. You know, it's not a case of my country right or wrong, but their country right or wrong. Mm-hmm. They need to realize that I think that's so. We're starting with the negatives here, aren't you? What to do when you wake up, as it were? Realize that your country has made a terrible mistake and has sold itself. Well, you can be charitable and you can call it a paranoid lie because of the massive, the overwhelming disparity in numbers between you and the surrounding Arabs. Whatever it was, a decision was taken that these nations have to be broken up. Right. So there is no equilibrium in the region at the moment. What can an Israeli do that's positive? Well, if he is religious, of course, he will see his life first and foremost as service to Hashem and an embodiment of Torah. So again, this is pretty simple stuff, but maybe you need an outsider to say it occasionally. If Torah has told you that something is right, and even your own tradition received from the rabbis tells you something else, then, and similar movements, by the way, are happening in the most honest streams in Islam and Christianity right now, then you must reject your tradition where your tradition is not biblical. Okay, so that would be a message for the observant Jews, I think, in Israel. I think you know it perfectly well, those of you listening to me who are of this category, but I know that there's great fear of going against rabbinic tradition in many ways. But if rabbinic tradition has told you, just obey the government, whatever happens. I know some rabbis preach that, not many, but some do. And Torah says, stand up against wicked tyrants, even if they're your own, especially if they're your own kings and rulers. Then go with Torah. Your intuition tells you that anyway, but perhaps your neighbors and members of your synagogue and family might not tell you it. But that's the positive message, I think. Yeah, we could go many other ways with that, but perhaps you want to pick up on a couple of the things I already said there.
You know, it's I noticed, I had a chat with a friend, and I noticed that most rabbis who speak against the medical dictatorship were not born religious. They become, due to something that happened in their life, and each one with his own story, obviously, they become religious with over the years. And this is amazing because you can see most of the rabbis who actually break the lines and speak the truth and come forward to protect their community, they were not, they're not coming from the Orthodox Jewish tradition or institution or neighborhoods, but they chose to become a practicing Jew.
Yes.
And this is really unique. And again, for those who see it, I think it's really interesting to see it because, again, I know many of them, relatively many of them, because we're not that many, but, and the majority, if not all, again, maybe I'm wrong here by saying everyone, but the majority of them actually chose to be religious. Which is
and
really
actually, particularly here in the Netherlands and in the United States, those are the two countries with by far the biggest Bible belts of people who think that when they see the star with Mogen David on it, that they're seeing the banner of God's people, basically. Yeah, there are people from both of those countries who are very well known in social media who convert to Judaism, who become proselytes with no Jewish blood, and some of them make Aliyah as well. And they become the most aggressive drum bangers, as it were, for Israel. There's, you know, in fact, David can tell you more about it, but it's well known to any Israeli. There is such a thing as Jerusalem syndrome or Messiah syndrome. You know, people turn up there and they they think that this people and this place can do no wrong. Yes. Their leadership must be right. Yeah. So this is you need a very healthy dose of thinking from first principles. Yeah. Tradition of the ancestors, all well and good, but if it's starting to tell you things, and this happens to many streams of Christianity and Islam as well, if it's starting to tell you to do things which are obviously things that would shock the heathen, such as disown your family or kill your neighbor who never lifted a finger against you on the pretext that I must rise and kill first because he'll kill me, calm down, catch yourself on, as they say on Merseyside, have a word with yourself. And realize that whatever tradition this is, it's obviously not one from Torah.
True. What do you think the rest of the world should do? I mean, given we are facing like ancient evil shit that is hitting the fan, obviously, and someone is, you know, increasing the fan speed by the day. What should we do? I mean, I'm speaking now generally about the population of the world, those at least who know that they are globalists and Satanists and stuff like that?
The first thing to do is, if you haven't already, realize that your government is your enemy. But I say that in not a dramatic or rabble-rousing way. Mm-hmm. I do not say attack your government. Absolutely not. But realize that your government has been infiltrated by people who want to attack you. Whether you live in Chile or Iceland, this is the case, mm-hmm. right? Or even in a country that comparatively couldn't care less about COVID, like Belarus. I mean, who will say that Belarus, for example, is friendly to its citizens? Again, I'll get excommunicated by a section of UK column viewers and others now for saying that Lukashenko is not a good man. But by the way, the KGB recently went round and assassinated someone there, or rather they came to the door with guns and he shot before they could get him. That was a Jewish guy called Zaitsev. So again, you see Jews in well embedded in other countries as part of the patriotic and liberal opposition to tyranny, wherever it is. But mm-hmm. how do we get onto that? Because there are countries that, you know, choose not to go along with the COVID narrative, but they're not all heroes. Their leadership are not all heroes. Realize that your government is not your friend. And then do, and this again is something that Jews all over the world are very good at, because the biblical history and their tradition tell them to do it. Be economically independent. Excellent. Don't live on fresh air. Don't live on IOUs and promises that the government is there as a safety net for you. It is far more reliable to, and will become necessary again soon as well, or already is, to have around you a safety net of people who are tied to you by blood, or even better, by shared convictions. Normally people put that the other way around, but these days I think your intuition will tell you, don't say, oh, my family will support me when society cuts me off. If your family are all COVID maniacs, they're not. They're going to take pleasure in reporting you to the Gestapo. So don't trust them in those circumstances. Become self-sufficient. Okay, and don't do that as an individual. It's a plural thing to do.
Yes.
You know, join a group of like-minded people. Now, a particular problem for a Jew in this category, if he's in the diaspora, I think, is can he join a mixed group or a goy-dominated group of sensible, awake people who want to form a self-sufficient community? Or there will always be this concern, will they turn against me and scapegoat me? Yeah, or will this group protect me? Use your intuition in this regard.
It's so sad, you know, so I laugh because what can I do?
No, I really feel for, you know, you know, sensible Jews in diaspora who realize that, you know, Israel is not a state where the sun shines out of its backside. You know, it makes its own errors and sins. So those who don't make Aliyah, what do they do? They were previously well integrated into the economy of the country they're in. And I think French Jews in particular and Belgian Jews have had more of this problem than others in recent years. Do they stay and get literally targeted and cursed, or do they go to Israel where, you know, they may actually find themselves taking part in more oppression and uprooting? Because whether they want to or not, they tend to end up being sent to the West Bank, don't they? That's where the money is to settle them. It's a fantastically complicated issue.
Yes.
For Jews. But, you know, I think the best piece of advice I got from a viewer on this was always make sure that your intelligence and intuition are in step. Yeah. And often if you're on the religious side as a Jew or not, it's your intuition or your instincts will tell you to do certain things. But if your rational brain tells you that this is not right or righteous or good, then listen to your intelligence as well. You know, to take steps which both your brain and your gut tell you are good things to do.
Tell me, Alex. Maritime law. How should we bypass?
Right, for those who are new to this subject, it has been dawning on people in, I think, particularly the English-speaking countries for some decades now, that there is a fake law code which is in the minds of some of the people in our legal system, the people who really run the courts, that according to which, how shall we say, they operate as though admiralty law, the law of the sea, operates in courtrooms. And there are lots of people who talk in quite elaborate detail about this and say, well, when the judge or the clerk of the court uses this phrase, they're just tricking you. This is hotly denied by students of the law. And I have also formally studied law at law school. I didn't graduate, but I learned a lot there. And whichever jurisdiction you're in, the legal scholars will say, absolute nonsense, the law means what it means, right? But when you're dealing with a high proportion, this is the key, I think, the high proportion of members of secret societies in the judiciary and the associated professions, the clerks of the court, they are going to operate according to their mythology, right? So they are going to basically do the dirty on you as often as they can. So I suppose I've just answered the question for you. If the heart of the problem is not that there really is admiralty law, but if the heart of the problem is actually that you have to do with secret societies and corruption in the courts, then that's what needs to be brought to light. You know, from Portugal to Ireland, in the last few years, we have seen a number of brave individuals going through the court systems in their countries. In some countries, they are judges themselves, although the disciplinary panels tend to get them out of those positions. And they make the most success when they say to their legal persecutors, I challenge you to show clean hands. I challenge you to deny or to prove better that you're not a member of a secret society. And that's when they go mad.
Hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
That is the heart of the issue.
Yeah.
So, let's take the issue further, because we're very keen in the UK Column and associated movements like the British Constitution Group to stress this. Whether or not your country currently has a jury system, that is the solution that you should be lobbying for at the political and judicial level. Juries are composed of fallen men and women, but they make more sensible and less corrupt decisions in every territory of the world where they exist than a professional state-paid judiciary. So that is the best remedy against that. But it also needs a backbone. I mean, England and America have very extensive uses of the jury. In America, often even in civil cases. Yet if the jury consists of people drawn from the current society that they're in, which of course they do, and most of those are totally unconcerned, nonchalant about the law, and just think, well, I'll do what the judge tells me to do, then you've lost that safeguard.
Yes.
Yeah, so start with yourself and your own environment, and actually ensure as best you can that society is composed of people who are zealous for truth and justice. There's not going to be a magic formula to get rid of corrupt judges, whether or not you think you've seen the light and realized the secret code involved in the law. Well, you'll never be able to prove it. The body language of those you're dealing with will jolly well tell you you're right, but you'll never be able to prove it or use an abracadabra to deal with it.
Well, we certainly need to try everything we can. I mean, all venues and all ways in order to win over that and to overcome this duels. And maybe just one before last. I know that at least partly in your research, you've touched upon the royal families or the families behind the families, those who run things, the banksters, they're not even banksters because they're just considered to be royal blood. They marry between among themselves, and they control vast amount of resources over decades and centuries. If you can really briefly, what's their story? What they're on about? I mean,
the Nevi'im said it best, didn't they? So they described how the aristocracy growing in ancient Israel got to that position by, quote, grinding the faces of the poor.
Mm.
Yeah. And in one phrase from the Bible there, you have so much truth, right? So what should a traditionally minded Christian, Jew or Muslim think about his aristocracy over him? Should he bow down and worship them? No, there's only one God he should bow down and worship. Should he be an anarchist? No, because all these religions agree you are to fear God and keep his commandments. But he should have, although he tends to be politically conservative, a believer in the monotheistic religions, he should have a healthy skepticism about the aristocracy. And that is a hard sell for people who've grown up in certain traditions, whether they were, you know, British Tories or conservative Jews in Israel. Of course, you're a new country politically and you don't have that sort of aristocracy, but you certainly do have it in business, which you've always had in Judaism or in Jewry around the world, right? But how do they get these positions? Almost certainly not by extraordinary strokes of luck or by fantastic genius or incredible hard work, almost always by what the economist would describe as unfree markets, captured markets. And this is so much of where the Jews have been blamed throughout history, often unfairly, of course. And sometimes they've given themselves a rod for their own backs by participating in these monopolies. But if you take part in a stitched-up market where you are effectively, through, for example, regulation or the like, by lobbying, you're the only company or the only cartel that can supply a certain good or service in a certain market, you will enrich yourself. And before long, with the passage of time, this will become, you will become literally or figuratively ennobled. You know, the I don't want to pick just on the Rothschilds because I don't think they're the world kings, but they accepted before the foundation of the State of Israel, at least, the title King of the Jews, didn't they? Right. This was one of their the titles that they allowed themselves to be given by their followers. So just from a halachic point of view, you know, something's gone wrong there. You're not supposed to have any king but Hashem, right? That's a repeated theme of Torah. Okay, of course you had the Davidic kingship, but that's not in conflict with that. But if a guy allows himself through benefactors, being a benefactor, much like happened in Gentile times at the, you know, Gentile economies at the same time, the Rockefellers, for example, and others, then obviously you're going to capture the loyalty of a lot of people. So, and if that's the pool out of which monarchy comes, and then, of course, many countries trash their monarchy in a revolution, often the agitation there is again blamed on the Jews, I'm afraid, but if they trash their monarchy and end up with a presidency, then a few families in the country will become oligarchs. So you still end up with noble leadership. No, well, you want to go for solutions, don't you, Shai? You're quite keen to. So I think here the solution, again, is have as little to do with them as possible. Be a family that doesn't need them. And this needs old-fashioned moral and religious values. It needs hard work, saving rather than spending. It needs the hard work of having many children, something which is a big issue in Israel demographics, because the seculars are always petrified of being outbred by the observant. Yeah, but your Arab neighbors often talk about it as a jihad of the womb, don't they? You know, to give them their due, the hunger strikers and others in Belfast in the old days in the Northern Irish Troubles talked about your revenge being the laughter of your children. Mm-hmm. This is very relevant to the question of, you know, being vexed by a corrupt ascendancy. You know, what can I do against them? Well, ensure that your clan, as it were, outlives them through having better values. But then that means the hard work is down to you to teach your children those values.
Yes, which is fine by me. I mean, I'm all up for it, because that's, in a way, it's also, if not only, God's will, to follow this path and to do, again, like it says on the screen here, you know, step away from evil and do good. It's in our hands. It's our, I would say, you know, it's like a duty, but it's also the greatest right ever is to do this, to step away from evil and do good. And it's amazing it's really important also to give it to our children, to the next generation, especially now with all this witchcraft spell casting on all the population of the world. And I know that what you said is true. We need to step away from them and find ways to do it, like Frank Sinatra said, my way or our way. And we've done it in the past. We forgot, we got, you know, we fell asleep, we got hooked on many gadgets and many items and you know, school of thoughts. But it's time to go back, in a way, to a very basic, simple but good lifestyle. And I think we can do it as long as we do it together. Because one by one, it's really difficult. That's exactly what they want. But if we do it together and share knowledge, tools, venues, land, resources, we can easily actually do it. Yes. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And you are, if I may, just read a couple of paragraphs from an email I just got, which is relevant to this as well. This is one an answer to one of your earlier questions. What can awake Israelis do? Well, you might be aware that Orthodox Jews, and I don't mean the sort of nutcase fringe guys that you all love to hate, but just simply observant Jews with good traditional morality around the world, are being persecuted by particularly Western and Anglo governments for their moral stance. Mm-hmm. This is happening to Muslims and Christians as well in Western countries. So if you want a positive way of being connected with world Judaism, then think about those back in the diaspora who are being persecuted. And I've got one from a very worthy man here, an email from a gentleman called Arthur Goldberg in New York, who is always being sued. And he is founder and director of a group called Jonah. And because he's provided resources to people who have homosexual thoughts and do not wish to be homosexual, okay, they don't involve them in they don't persecute homosexuals by any means, but they provide help to those who don't wish to be troubled with homosexual feelings. That has led them to them being sued by the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC. Again, a group which often gets itself accused of being a front for so-called world Jewry. But you see here that this is you know, streams of so-called Judaism at each other's throats. So you need to have a deeper think if that's what you think is going on. And he says that Arthur Goldberg has been fighting against so-called politically incorrect positions, but they are biblically correct, he says, through organizations and programs such as Jonah, JIFGA, that's an acronym, J-I-F-G-A, and Funding Morality. But he says that he's been emotionally and financially overwhelmed by litigation by the SPLC. If people wish to see a whole overview, go to stream.org, S-T-R-E-A-M.org, and find the page, The Southern Poverty Law Center Persecutes Orthodox Jews. It's as basic as that. And then he wishes, if people are moved by that, they can go to the website naturallawdefense.org. That's spelt the American way with an S-E on the end, naturallawdefense.org. And there's a page there called the Legal Defense Fund for former JIFGA and Funding Morality. And you know, it's too involved to give more of the story, but that is just one practical example. It might surprise some of your Israeli listeners, perhaps not all of them would be surprised, but some, I think, that it is increasingly difficult to live as a religious anything, as a Jew, a Christian, a Muslim, or anything in much of the West, in many of the countries that you Israelis regard as your strategic allies.
Yes.
Right? And so if these countries are making it impossible for a Jew to live as a Jew, that should tell you something.
Alex Thompson, thank you very much for your presence and for your knowledge and kind words and wisdom. Yeah, something tells me I want to do another talk with you.
Very gladly.
Yes, other things you've spoke about. And thank you for your answers. I really enjoyed your answers. I asked relatively short questions and I got relatively short answers from various angles. Thank you very much for enlightening us.
You're very, very welcome. And if you want to ask more, I can't promise a reply to every email, but alex@ukcolumn.org.
Did you get that, guys? Let me write it. Alex at UK column.org. Yes. Column is double M?
No, C-O-L-U-M-N.
N. There you go.
See? As in a press column, yes.
Yeah, excellent. I'm not shy to ask that, you know.
Shy who is not shy, as it were.
So alex@ukcolumn.org. Yes,
yes, that's your email. That's so, the one.
You are most welcome to ask Alex some questions and get in touch with him. Alex, thank you very much. Now, hope to see you very soon. All the best.
God thank bless you.
The one with big G, obviously.
Okay, absolutely. God bless you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.